Okay, well, welcome along to this session on what for us here at Macquarie is a very exciting topic, in that we've been given the budget and the go-ahead to build a whole new physical library for Macquarie. And it's probably one of the few instances where we're actually doing that rather than renovating an existing library. That's happening all over the place. But we had quite an interesting set of discussions around our ability to actually renovate an existing building. If, for those of you not from Macquarie, the existing library is actually out the windows directly behind you. It's one of the original three courtyard buildings, as they're known at Macquarie. And it was physically built right in the centre of the campus, and that was a deliberate strategy by the Vice-Chancellor, the initial Vice-Chancellor, understanding that the library was actually the heart of the academic endeavour, and he wanted to put a real physical manifestation on that. So, of course, from our perspective, shifting out of the middle, the very middle of the campus, is actually one of the issues about upping and moving. But I'm pleased to be able to tell you we're actually just moving south. We're still in the central part of the campus. We're just getting a bit closer to the road, which is actually quite good from an access point of view. So you might be wondering what the heck is talk about a new physical library for Macquarie doing in the middle of a conference on learning design. And the reason is that we're building a new library simply really because that building has outlived its usefulness in how you conceive of people learning in physical space or indeed in any space. The reason being that the focus on building libraries in the 60s and prior to that and even in the last couple of decades was always from the point of view of librarians being the guardians of the printed word and really trying to protect at all costs that printed word from, you know, being pinched and defaced and all the terrible things that we know students do. And so the focus around building for libraries was always around minimising the amount of light coming in the windows because that's bad for print, and it was around having the maximum space available for the physical collection. And the world is now turned on its head, and it's not the way students learn. The way we describe our building is that it's pretty much like a concrete bunker that's a bit institutionalised, that has overhead lighting, that's fluorescent, and its message is, you're in my space, sit down, shut up, and behave yourself. And that's the message that we as library staff were sending to our customers. What we're trying to do, and this is actually a concept design photograph of the front of the new library, is to totally turn that on its head so that the focus of this new space is actually on people using and interacting in the space. And we're going to achieve that by actually trying to minimise the amount of space that our physical collections take up. So the innovative thing that we're doing in this library is actually to implement what's called an automated storage and retrieval system, effectively a very big warehousing vault that's operated by automated cranes that will in fact retrieve and deliver a lot of our print collection into the future to our clients in the building and elsewhere on campus. And that, of course, as you can imagine, has all sorts of challenges associated with it, not least of which is people desiring to browse in physical collections. So there will be a balance between what's on open access and what's actually in that physical storage area. But the whole point of the exercise is to recognise that we need a lot more space for our clients to interact with each other, with electronic resources, and also with print resources. So we're not throwing away the print, I'll say to those of you in the audience who happen to be librarians or very attached to print. You should see my home library. You'd know from that, just looking at it, that I'm pretty attached to print as well and will continue to be. But what we realise is that print's no longer necessarily the game of the future. It's part of that game. And so we really don't want to have the emphasis in a physical library on the print resources. And I think that's where we start to touch on the relationship between what we're trying to do in library design and what you're trying to do in learning design. And that's why this is not really a presentation about how that new library will look. It's about the thinking we're doing around what we call informal learning space that helps to support what you're doing from a pedagogical perspective as far as actually delivering course content and interaction with students. So what are the kinds of things we have talked about? And we've got that there. What does this library look like? Where do we get that evidence from? And therefore what our key planning concepts were. And of course, the library is only one space. There are lots of spaces around on campus. So, and then finally, and how does this all mean anything as far as learning design is concerned? So just to start with a bit of a definition, basically what's now starting to emerge in people's writing and thinking is, in this age of information and interaction, I would argue, and we'll come back to that in a minute, all space is learning space. So the space you're sitting in now is a learning space, the grass outside is a learning space, the foyer of a lecture building is learning space, a computer is part of the learning space. Anywhere can be actually considered as learning space, and all those spaces need to interact and exist for different purposes. So we're moving away from just thinking about what are called there the formal learning spaces, and really the definition around that seems to be that's where the teacher is leading what's going on, as opposed to the informal ones where it's actually the student potentially who is engaged in some activity with or without the teacher being present. So again, just coming back to that, the information age, the kind of thing we're seeing is of course user-created content more and more, and you of course will be seeing that in the learning design space as well. How do you enable students to create content? And coming in on the end of the last discussion, how do you make sure that content actually has some provenance and actually people are aware of where it comes from and the veracity or otherwise of that content? And that's a very big issue that we're all starting to face. And then the interaction age is really where we are now. We've gone beyond the information age, in my opinion. We're really not only creating content, but people are interacting in both physical and virtual space using some of those new social networking tools that you're all obviously well aware of. And so for us, in looking at the difference between individual study and group study in that virtual environment, that's a picture of somebody engaged in individual study. This is a picture of somebody engaged in group work. And of course, that person is using things like Skype, potentially webcam, effectively can be engaged in group work, doesn't physically have to be in the same space, although of course group work happening in that environment is also an important thing for other reasons for students. So let's think about what our access to information is around. Just to give you a little bit on from a library perspective, how do we know we've actually shifted, I guess, in terms of our reliance on print? And I think interestingly for us, what we've known for the last couple of years, and we reached this kind of watershed about the end of 2005, our business is now very much half and half. Every day of the year, when we average it out, we have 5,500 sets of feet that go in and out of our exit doors. Plays havoc with the carpet, I can tell you, in terms of that much traffic. But every day we also have 5,500 web visits. Now that's not hits, that's actual visits as measured by some of the tools that are available to you to really look at what constitutes some kind of real interaction with the content that, or the services that are there. So you can see it's about even now in terms of where we're up to. Two-thirds, and it's probably more than that this year, of what we call used to call our book vote in our acquisitions budget. It's a real misnomer these days. It actually goes on licensing electronic resources. So we're actually spending that much of our ongoing book vote. And that gets manifested in what we hold. So back in 1999, we had no e-books and very few electronic journals. Now look what we've got. And that figure is just going up exponentially. The loans of our physical items, I would have said when we wrote this, were starting to decrease. They've actually plateaued. So we're still lending about 400,000 items from the print collection a year, but that's not going up. Right now it's just steady state. But what we do know, of course, because of things on reading lists and all the hot things that students have to read, you can bet, and it's the same in just about any academic library, that 20% of the things we hold satisfy 80% of the demand. So that's the things that are in heavy demand as far as teaching is concerned. So what are people saying that kind of usage will be like 20 years from now, because we're having to plan? Well, technically speaking, since that library's been standing for 40 years, we know the next one probably will be too, but it's too long a planning horizon for anybody these days. So we're saying, what are we predicting 20 years from now? Well, electronic journals are pretty much in the academic environment reached saturation anyway, so that's going to flatten out. It's been exponential over the last 10 years, there's no doubt about that. And I would say if you were a publisher of a print journal in the academic sphere, and I'm not talking about popular magazines and those kinds of things, but definitely in academe, if you're only producing your journal in print, you're a threatened species. No doubt about that. People are still producing in both print and electronic, but the primary form of distribution has become electronic in the academic arena. There's no doubt about that, and that will continue and plateau out. Books are a different thing. Take up of e-books has actually been much, much slower, largely because there's something about the format of a printed book that actually fits with us as human beings, and it means you don't need electricity and you can take it to the beach, get in the bath without electrocuting yourself, do all sorts of things with a book that you can't yet do comfortably with a laptop or a handheld device. And at the moment in the e-book arena, we're seeing probably the VHS versus beta wars happening in terms of the format of the actual readers. And it won't be until we actually get over that one that you really start to see e-books, I think, take off. Also, the publishers are being fairly cagey, shall we say, in some respects about letting their content go on e-books. But you're starting to see all sorts of new models coming. Very many big publishers around the world now are working in with electronic providers on various platforms to make sure that their books never go out of print, so that the actual first copy that's generated in electronic form is always held as a backlist, and print on demand will be what will enable those copies to be able to be made available in what's called the long tail, if you follow the kind of Web 2 discussions over the years of publication. So that's one thing that's happening. Probably the publishers of textbooks are the least likely to be participating in those models at the moment, because they're looking at other ways, and that again relates to your area of expertise, in how they hook up some of that content in an online environment with learning management systems and learning design directly, rather than needing to produce it as a book. So it's actually content that then becomes part of the teaching and learning environment. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with textbooks. But that we're certainly predicting, and we're in fact investing next year quite heavily in increasing significantly the number of e-books we have available in the environment.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Traditionally a lot of the more specialist academic textbooks have been quite expensive.
Yes. Absolutely.
Are those types of textbook manufacturers facing the same sort of challenges that, for example, the retailers of cheap music are facing?
Absolutely.
Where your $30 CD is now at 99 cents now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly why they're hanging on to their content, because they don't yet know what the business model is by which they can continue to get the same profits out of our environment that they have been up until now. I mean, I think the profit-taking that's been happening in publishing can't be continued. There is sort of a cycle in most industries where you get to the cash cow stage. That's where we are with publishing. They're realising that they're not going to be able to sustain that to the future. So they're making as much money out of us now as they can in order to invest in these new technologies, but nobody's yet figured out what the actual business model for survival is going to be.
And
so it's going to be very interesting.
Same way the music industry has gone to like singles on demand as opposed to buying a whole album.
Yep.
Is there any trend that's selling you the chapter on climate change?
There certainly will be with the textbook publishers, there's no doubt about that. The information about other books that are more specialised, that are now available in electronic form, typically what they're finding is people who release the whole thing online are increasing their sales of print on demand, because people just don't want to sit there and read a 300-page book online. So, but they can see the content, so they know they want it, so they're actually buying it. It's a really interesting set of changes that's starting to happen in the marketplace. So I think that's a really interesting one to watch in terms of creating content for online environments. Where is that material going to come from? The other thing those publishers and some of the big ones are talking to us about, what they call active content, and that means rather than having a flat textbook that's just text with examples, they're going to have clickable content that says if you've got a formula in a maths book, you can actually click on it and start manipulating things that are happening. So I think we're going to see a lot more active content coming into that space as well, and that's the other one. So, of course, what we're predicting is that there's going to be more and more in electronic form, which is not to say there won't still be print books for the future, but the rate of production of print is going to decline quite a bit. So the big questions we faced, of course, with investing over $70 million in a new physical library on campus, not a small amount of money, is, you know, there are two things going on here. Students say, you know, on the net, what do I need a physical campus for? And because they're so busy and sometimes working more than one job to pay their hex debt and various other things, and you guys will probably relate to that over there, it's, you know, what do I need to come to campus for? And can't that experience be made a bit more involving than just turning up in a physical lecture? And then, of course, I've got Google, so what do I need the library for? And I know you're confronting that in your environment as well. And it's been quite interesting trying to work through some of the answers to those questions. And, of course, we know the answer, in terms of libraries. What we say is we can point you to the good stuff and the stuff you need to be able to really engage with what's going on in your lectures. You know, you can do a Google search and turn up something, but is it the something that you're actually going to need? So increasingly for us, it's a value add. It's not getting the stuff. the old model of physical libraries was you needed one every so often because it was a scarce resource. Now we've got the opposite problem. There's so much stuff out there. How do you actually find the good stuff and the right stuff as far as learning what's going on in a discipline? So where did our evidence base for planning some of the work, particularly around informal spaces, come from? Two fairly large initiatives, one in the US, which is the EDUCAUSE Learning Initiative. I'm sure you're all familiar with the work of EDUCAUSE. And JISC, the Joint Information Systems Council in the UK, which is one of the central funding bodies. And they're both really focusing on this whole issue of learning space, both physical and virtual. So in terms of thinking about space, there's quite an interesting writer who was actually the Yale University librarian, who is now a space planner in his retirement. And he's very interested in what are the questions you ask when you're going to design physical space. And his comment is that most of us switch straight into our what we know. And from a library perspective, we're no different. The first question my staff will say, apart from where's my desk and is there a staff toilet and where do I park, you know, you've got to get the good things right, is we start thinking about it from where's the reference desk, where's the circulation desk, not what are the physical spaces that our clients need and what are they going to be doing in that space. So it's really turning your thinking on its head. And those things are important, but they've got to be in a different way. So the questions that Bennett asks in that article about the key questions is, and that's really relevant to you guys, what do you need a physical learning space for anyway these days when you can do so much of this online? And so there is some evidence about that which suggests in some cases an immersion learning environment can't just be virtual. You actually do need some social interaction, and that comes on to the next one. But it also sometimes means if you're dealing with the design of a building or something tangible in a class, sometimes you actually need to see the physical thing as well as be able to model it in an online space. So there are aspects of some types of immersion learning that you need a physical space for. Social dimensions of learning, I think, are really important. The discussions about, well, students don't need to come to campus anymore, may be very true for someone who is a busy postgraduate student who already has a network within their professional or other community, who's already got those contacts. I think it would be a very lonely life for an undergraduate student who has no network, who doesn't yet have that kind of connection, to actually completely engage unless they have other reasons for needing not to be able to get on campus, of not having that kind of social dimension. And there are certainly very powerful tools now that allow people to interact in virtual space, but there's no substitutes. A bit like, why are you here? If you're all in the virtual space, why do you come to a conference anymore? Well, there's something about physical networking and meeting people that makes that interaction in a virtual space even more rich, usually, that you know the bit about the person at the other end. And certainly collaborative learning can be different in different kinds of spaces as well. And quite often, from our perspective, with dance studies, with music and other things, that actual performance is a very important thing. And while you can do that and record it and make it available, the actual interaction with a live performance, as you would all know from attending concerts and other things, is a different thing than actually listening to it or looking at it later on. So there are some interesting observations about the differences of those things. His second question is, so if you need that space, how might you design it so that students would spend more time studying and studying productively, what's more? And so there is again some evidence that students who actually do come on campus, and I guess these are all from the US, what's called the NESI surveys, the national surveys that they do of student behaviour, that physical interaction actually does help with what's called deep learning. And that is that students learn by doing, they learn by bouncing off each other. And again, they can do some of that in a virtual environment, but the physical environment adds another layer, and there's some evidence that that's actually quite important. And the social dimension, of course, it's really saying that the same thing, that that's much more productive if there is that social dimension. So that's why spaces like cafes and places like this, the Student Union building and other buildings on campus and other areas on campus, and just walking to and from lectures actually has part of the provision of that kind of social dimension as well. So in terms of physical space, interesting to think about how these tie up with the qualities of good virtual space, I suppose, too. The things that students report all the time as far as physical space, and I'm talking about informal learning space here, although you probably might think the first two could apply to formal learning space, is convenience. You know, it's got to be a space that's easy to deal with, that's available to them when they need it. It's got to be comfortable. So that gets back to that comment I made about our library design currently being very institutional. It makes you sit up straight at a tiny little desk in the corner and makes you be quiet, whereas the whole view is now much more about indirect lighting, about the library being like your lounge room or your bedroom or something at home, where you feel much more comfortable about what you're doing. And then quiet, but quiet doesn't mean quiet. Same word doesn't mean the same thing to all people. For some people, quiet needs enough background noise to actually prove that you're still alive. And that's what that comment on the bottom is about, not getting bored or falling asleep, that people want enough going on in a space to feel they're connected to it. Some people, of course, still want absolute quiet to do certain things, and other people just can't work unless there's absolute noise everywhere. It really seems to be not a generational thing, it's a personality thing and what people have grown up with, I think. I don't think it is this kind of Gen X, Gen Y thing. It's about what you're used to and what your actual personality and your makeup demands. So they're the sorts of things that students are saying that they want. And so this is kind of convenience in the sense that libraries have now all changed their policies to say we can't expect you to sit there for 8 hours without a drink of water, which used to be the rule in the library. You couldn't eat or drink, couldn't do anything else. Obviously you need to be able to do all the things that make you feel that you can do the things you need to do in a space and you're not sort of jumping around. That's a convenience factor. The comfort factor again, well, you know, what you're allowed to eat and drink and where you're allowed to do it is another question that comes up in that slide. And then the comfort factor is, you know, what kinds of furniture might you have? And we increasingly find students who would rather sit on the floor than sit up at a desk. And so providing beanbags, cushions, you know, carpet that's a bit more than just stuck to the concrete in terms of comfort is actually one of the ways of providing that space. So quite an interesting set of propositions starting to come out of that. But then there is this sense of sanctuary, that there's still a need, even though collaborative work, and I think I've got a later slide that talks about the fact that students tend to engage in collaborative work more as they progress through their years at university, so it may be slightly less in those dreadful first year environments where you've got to sit through the lectures before they'll let you loose doing anything. Group work definitely does increase over time, but also the need to just shut people out and be able to sit there and do something in what's being now called sanctuary space is also really important. So, how much of each do you work to have, and can you actually change one sort of space into the other at some point in time as well? So, one of the interesting things that's now coming out of that, and there's that thing about it growing more important over the course of a student's work, we also notice what is now being called a tidal flow. So early in the semester, we probably get more of a demand for people just to be on their own. As you get to when the first big assignments are due, in the middle of the first semester, you'll get a whole lot more demand for group space, and then coming back to exam time, you'll get, I want quiet space that's just my space. So we've really got to think about how to manage the way we plan that space. And of course, flexibility in any kind of space these days is governed by two things. One is the wireless network as far as laptop access, great. MIT and wireless power, Wi-tricity as it's called, is the thing we've got our eye on because the killer at the moment is powering these darn things. And for students, that's the biggest bugbear, apart from the weight of them, of actually lugging them around on a campus. So that ultimate freedom is only going to come when we can actually either solve the battery problem in these things or have wireless electricity, which doesn't kill us. At the moment, I think there's a bit of a problem with that. So the kinds of things that people are starting to develop about collaborative space, this is an example from Durham. These are called the techno cafes. What you can see in there is a big LCD screen the student can actually plug a laptop into. These are spaces where you can practice presentations, a real need as far as students are concerned in terms of group work. We've got no space like that on campus at the moment for students. A place where you can go and actually talk about things. Some of the walls of these spaces are glass instead of being whiteboards, so the students can actually write. You know, you can write up equations, you can write up ideas, you can do all kinds of things. But you can see that they're partially enclosed, so you've got that sense of a space that you can work in, make noise in, and not actually necessarily disturb anybody else. So lots of quite interesting, and that's a close-up of inside one of those. The other thing that's actually quite interesting when people have revamp their library or other informal spaces is this concept of studying along. And this gets back to what quiet means to students. One of the things that I have asked students as part of the reality check about spending over $70 million on a new library building is, so why do you come here anyway? You know, tell me the answer to why you need us rather than just Google. What they tell me to a student is, I've got to come somewhere where I can get serious. So I relate to this because the last time I was a postgrad student, I had the cleanest house you've ever seen. And I hate housework. But I'd find anything else to do rather than do the assignment. So I had, you know, this brilliant house and, you know, didn't fail the assignments but came close. And so it's saying I need to actually set myself up mentally to deliver. And that's what having some kind of structured space is about. And I think that's an interesting one to carry into the virtual environment as well. And so what students like to do, if they don't want the actual sanctuary space, they want to come into a space where other students are working. Don't necessarily want to work with them in a group, but they want to sit down sort of near somebody who might help them keep focused because they're working as well. So it's this concept of studying along, which is a really interesting one, I think. And so there's an example of students sort of studying along, although that's a bit the old kind of rows and rows of computer model that we don't like too much anymore. And then the other one, which I alluded to in terms of how we start designing space, is this idea that there's a sense that authority is actually transmitted in space. And at the moment, the unwritten word is that I'm kind of delivering the presentation and therefore I'm kind of in a position of power, if you like. You can all get up and walk out. None of you have yet, which is nice. You're about to. But that's what we actually communicate in a typical classroom. There's a teacher up the front, and that's the person in the position of power. They're the only ones who can alter anything to do with the room, usually, even the way we set it up with technology these days. And so there's certain non-too-subtle things that get communicated about how we design space and who we think's in charge by the way we do that. And so how we design space actually affirms that or otherwise. So there's the one about the teacher at the front, but librarians ensconced behind monumental reference desks is the one that we kind of pick up, or a monumental desk of any kind. Immediately there's a service desk, and particularly one where you've got to kind of peer over the top of it. The message is the person behind this desk has some power over you. They're either going to hit you with a fine, oh, okay, come back. What's wrong? We've got a battery. You've got a plug in.
Thank you, Maggie.
Ah, the plug's out. There's a plug on the floor. Look.
I was plugged into the machine. It's just
the machine isn't plugged in. It's just sitting on the E drive. There we go. Thank you. Okay, see what I mean about power? It was a great demonstration, wasn't it? Okay, so we've really got to worry about what messages we're sending in the design of space, and I want to draw the analogy there about how virtual space learning design is also an issue. And so there's an example of a monumental reference desk over on the left as you're facing it. And then the idea of trying to break that down to something that's much more inviting, less of a barrier between you and the people you're dealing with. In fact, we're thinking about no desk and how people might be identified and have a space that they can actually go to and have a consultation with someone, but it's not this whole idea of having to approach someone that's in control. Okay, should the space be designed to encourage student-teacher exchange outside the classroom? The little note on the bottom was for our academic staff here. The problem in the library at the moment is we have about 1,100 seats for 22,000 EFTSU. Competition is pretty stiff. And the new library will, you know, double and then some the number of seats available in it because of that focus on students. So our aim is to seat 1 in 10 of our EFSU at any given time, and that's the sort of standard that we want to move towards as far as best practice as far as big libraries are concerned. So from an academic's perspective, they don't want to come into the library to work anymore because they're actually besieged by students when they do. So they tend to go to other libraries other than ours so that their students don't do that to them, just because there really isn't a space that they have for sanctuary, I suppose. So what we've put out on the table is, well, do you want a space to work with your students, or do you want us to rent you a disguise so you can actually walk around? And I think it's a combination of having some sanctuary space but also having some spaces where interaction can occur with students in the library if that's what the lecturer wishes to do. And then finally, how might this space enrich educational experiences? And there are all sorts of ways people are starting to do this. One of them is actually making those spaces part of the overall environment and celebrating the achievements of learning and teaching in the space. And we're actively looking at the moment about how we might do that even in the existing library to really make a space feel like it's part of the overall experience of learning, not just an add-on. And so that's an example of a new college library that actually has some electronic display space actually for showcasing the work. One of the things we're looking at on the front of the new library is actually having an active video wall that can actually project all sorts of things that are going on campus at any given time, really trying to bring the life of the campus into the informal space. So as I said at the beginning, our major thrust in really doing this is getting away from this collection-centred focus of the world where everything was about protecting the print, and not even in most cases even encouraging you to borrow it or use it or anything else, to being much more centred around what learners are doing and how they're trying to do that, and obviously get to the point where we're doing those things supporting research, learning and personal development in the new network environment. Yes?
Can I just ask a question about what are the green implications, to use a phrase,
mm-hmm.
of what you're doing in your new library? Because I mean, a lot of these things are predicated, for example, on lots of electricity being used.
Yes.
Under any pressure to address those concerns?
Absolutely. One of our key design principles is to get a 5-star rating under the new educational pilot for the sustainability of things that we're doing in the building. So that's very, very key. It is tricky because the services engineers have said to me, what's the peak load in this new building? And I said, assume a bum on every seat and a laptop or the equivalent at every table, and that's the heat load that you've got to be really thinking about. So we're looking at how we might actually build things into this design that are adding to the sustainability objectives on campus more generally. And there's a whole lot of those, including mixed mode and all sorts of different ways of approaching airflow and those sorts of things that we're looking at. But yeah, that's one of the goals of the building, is to achieve a 5-star rating, which is no mean feat to do in something like this. So a very real issue. And the heat load is one of the biggies. Yeah. Okay. So planning things that we're picking up, and you can see environmental sustainability on the bottom there. Supporting active and social learning in what's called valued space, and that means it actually engages people. It's not just space that's sitting there. And the other thing we're trying to do, which again links up with your environment in the virtual sense, is we want to become invisible in the online world, and that's a real challenge. Once you're invisible, why does anybody think they need you? And so people have a tendency not to want to be invisible. What we mean by that is that we should pop up in a learning flow where a student needs us. There shouldn't have to be a conscious decision to say, oh, I'm going to the library now, which is what's happening with a lot of even the systems that we have in place. It's that the resources are there, that they come in and the services come in at a point where both learners and researchers need them. So it's really looking at workflow and how we appear in that workflow. Obviously, improving our access to electronic things, but still maintaining print, because in the next 20 years, and I think probably for longer, that's still going to be a very important thing. And of course, from our point of view, it's how we contain the cost of doing all of those things and being responsible in this environment in two ways. One is that it's value for money that we're doing for the university, but it's also environmentally sustainable that we were just talking about. So, how is this or is it relevant? Well, fostering student engagement and capability won't always be in the online environment. It's the pairing of the online and the physical environment that's important for the future. And so the questions we're asking ourselves at Macquarie at the moment are these. What are our expectations for our graduates? What makes somebody want to come to Macquarie rather than going somewhere else? And then importantly, if we have those aspirations, are those aspirations actually reflected in the way we're designing space? and services physically and virtually. And that's the missing link. It has been the missing link for quite a while. And what are the kinds of learning activities that we might want to engage in order to really deliver on that? And so the kinds of things that we're doing at Macquarie through the Learning and Teaching Committee now in trying to progress some of that, well, the first thing is, what are the current learning activities that our students are involved in? What do they want to be able to do? And we're looking at how we might do that in association with identifying or reaffirming our graduate attributes. And then actually physically taking that and putting it into the planning process as we start to revamp spaces that really haven't been looked at in some cases for 40 years. And that is it. So, questions?